I'm Christine Brennan with USA Today.
I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
And I'm Mike Lupica of the New York Daily News and SportsOnEarth.com. And welcome to the Monday Morning Sports Reporters Podcast. We have a lot to talk about because we constantly talk about various doomsday scenarios in college football. And we got one on Saturday when Miami decided to lose to Pittsburgh. But now we get one because Auburn on its home field beats Alabama. Not just beats them, but beats them pretty significantly. It's going to knock Alabama out of the top four. But with the conference, Bobby, with the conference championships coming up on Saturday, and with Georgia a chance to move right back up if they can beat Auburn, the season gets better and better and better.
It does, and the first thing that comes to mind is the very real possibility of Alabama not getting in at all. And I keep trying to break down, everybody has his or her own methodology, and I'm not sure I have one that's consistent. I've never been known for consistency. I tried to break this down, Mike and Chris, into best win that each of these contenders has and loss, if a loss, or worst loss. And the fact of the matter is that Alabama doesn't have, their signature wins are LSU and at Mississippi State. Now, and I'm not putting that, LSU figures in this thing very interestingly, by the way, but that doesn't get my
Bobby,
blood
before Chris,
racing.
Before Chris weighs in, let me just ask you a question because you made me think of an interesting point. Alabama's best loss is better than their two best wins.
Yeah, no kidding. And let me just get one right off the top, and I'll cede the floor. There is no doubt that if I were on the committee and it came down to a tiebreaker involving Clemson, that the egregious loss to Syracuse eliminates them automatically. I'm sorry. That is an inexplicable loss to a team that never won another game and which gave up an average of 52 points a game in its final three losses. Sorry.
Well, you know, Bob, I think we can all agree, you know, obviously the SEC is going to have a team in there. Auburn against Georgia, you know, the winner of that is in. ACC, I know what you're saying about Clemson, Miami, but I do think it looks like the winner of that ACC championship will be in. You've got Oklahoma and TCU. Oklahoma wins that, they're in. And then you come to the Big Ten. Now, if Wisconsin wins, I think this notion that Wisconsin, you know, we had a soft schedule. Well, hey, they're the only one of two undefeated teams, and obviously the highest ranked, and they've done everything asked of them. We will see. We will know. So anyone who wonders about Wisconsin being soft or whatever, you're going to find out. Because if Wisconsin beats Ohio State, a very good Ohio State team, Wisconsin then is the fourth team in. They go to the playoff. If Ohio State beats Wisconsin, there's the rub, because now you've got Ohio State and you got Alabama sitting at home waiting. And I think, to the points you were making, Bob, I absolutely think that Ohio State, the tougher schedule by a little bit, and then if they beat Wisconsin, that will be a huge boost for them. I think Ohio State, a two-loss Ohio State, should go, just like two-loss Auburn will be in there if they win, and Alabama should sit home. I know there's going to be a lot of people screaming about that, but I really do believe that the winner of the Big Ten championship game should also make it.
Okay, but you can make a very strong case for Alabama, a one-loss Alabama team, to go past a two-loss Ohio State team, even if it beats Wisconsin. Which, by the way, if we're talking about signature victories, Wisconsin probably would get its most significant victory on Saturday if it beats Ohio State. But let's talk about that. Do you really believe, and I know Alabama's banged up. I get all that, okay? At the end of the day, if Ohio State beats Wisconsin in the Big Ten championship game, are you going to, and Auburn wins against Georgia, are you going to put two lost teams in the tournament?
Well, first of all, this is the first time for everything, always, everything, and this is going to be, just without question, the most amazing. Wouldn't you love to be inside that room? I mean, we say that a lot, and I would love to be inside that room to see how they're going to rationalize this, because it kind of come down to gut feelings and rationalizations, because they're going to be presented with so many what-if scenarios or new scenarios, because this thing is a young thing anyway. We know that. And so when we say they've never done this, they've never done that, we're only talking about three or four, however many years, a few years. But the answer to your question, Mike, is I would personally, have no problem doing that. Now, part of the problem, one of the issues is, I'm going to ask you guys what you think about this. How do you personally factor in who's hot now as opposed to who had a signature win 2 months ago?
Well, that's a great point because, of course, even looking at this even last year, Ohio State last year and Alabama this year, because there's going to be a lot of talk about that. The Buckeyes beat Oklahoma last year. That was a big signature win for them. This year, Alabama wins, as you said, you know, talking about being hot. Alabama beats FSU in the season opener, Florida State, and we're saying, okay, you know, that's a big win. It turned out to be a nothing.
Yeah, we thought that was a big deal.
Right. It's a nothing because Florida State's, you know, awful. And so, you know, I think that Alabama's poor schedule, ranked in the 60s in terms of strength of schedule, it caught up with them. They looked horrible against Auburn, and they looked frazzled, and they looked like they couldn't, you know, they couldn't snap the ball, and they were making mistakes. Auburn outgained them by 140 yards. I mean, it was a drubbing, and 26-14, but it was actually seemed worse than that to me. So I would say if Ohio State beats Wisconsin, they are a much hotter team than Alabama that just had that bad loss.
And I keep looking at Auburn, and the two wins they have that jump out at you, Alabama and Georgia, and pummeling Georgia, and as you say, totally dominating Alabama. The only reason Alabama was in the game was Jalen Hurts, his individual brilliance. And their losses are damn good, you know, at Clemson and at LSU. And LSU, as we all know, historically, is a tough place to play. And as I say, LSU kind of factors into this tangentially, even though they're not involved directly. But
All right, let me ask.
Who's hotter than Auburn? Nobody.
Let me ask you this question, okay? Because we haven't really talked about the ACC championship game. Mm-hmm. Clemson, clearly, if they're winning, Clemson might be the hottest team right now. Auburn or Clemson is the hottest team, and Oklahoma might be the best team. Okay. But if Miami beats Clemson in the ACC championship game, is Miami automatically in? I'm not sure they are.
Yeah. Well, they would have to hang their hat on 41-8 over Notre Dame, and then how that
and explain away the loss to Pittsburgh, Bobby,
and explain away the loss to Pitt at Pitt. But you know, it's got to be tough. That's not quite as bad as losing to Syracuse, but in this big picture here, as we're examining bad losses, if we want to do so, I would probably be the second worst loss of the bunch.
Chris, think and again, it sounds like I'm pleading Alabama's case, and maybe I am a little bit. How much forgiveness do you give them for losing to a hot team in a rivalry game on the road on Saturday afternoon?
What I would give you, Mike, is I would give you Alabama replacing Clemson or Miami if that's a, you know, 9-6, you know, boring snoozer or whatever. It won't be. But
you're
going to
throw out the defending national champion with one bad loss and an ACC championship?
Well, or in the scenario of Miami, if Miami wins that, I would say there's a better chance, let me say it this way, of Alabama replacing Miami. Let's say Miami, not Clemson. Although, you know, that as we said, we already went through Clemson. But I would say there's a better chance, I would have a better shot of moving Alabama into that ACC slot, so to speak. I don't think it's going to happen, than taking the place of Ohio State. I do. And I think what this has all done, guys, as we know, as having covered this for a million years between us, among us, is that this is giving us exactly what college football should give us, which is the ultimate argument, and that no one's going to be satisfied. And frankly, when it was all those couple of those early years, it was kind of like, looked like these are the four for sure. College football is all about arguing. I love this. And if someone, you know, well, obviously someone's going to be sitting home complaining, whether it's Alabama, whether it's Ohio State, obviously Wisconsin wins, they're in. Clemson, if Miami doesn't make it, is in this scenario, right? That is fabulous overall for the game.
And how about the fact that we're talking about eight teams from this? Eight for four. And all the
it's why they can't go to eight, Bob. It's why they can never go to
eight. Oh, I don't want to go to eight, Mike. I never did. Oh, believe me.
Because this, it's all right. Now, let me ask you, let me ask you an interesting question about this, because I've been raving about the college football season. It's been so much more fascinating than the NFL season by a lot this year, unless you're living in Philadelphia or one of these hot pockets of new teams. But I ran, I'm probably going to write a column about a lot of what we're talking about today for Sports on Earth. And I ran this by Din Mann, who's a very smart guy, is my editor there. And he said, do you have any problem with one fact about this? That it's the usual suspects year after year after year, because the power structure in college football, to me, is way more pronounced than it is, you know, it's like there's four or five New England Patriots every year, even though only one of them win. Does it bother you that we're seeing this? Basically, Miami would be an outlier this year. The same teams year after year after year.
Well, it's not dissimilar to basketball at the top level either. It's a reality of big time college sports and basketball and football. Yes, it'd be nice to have a more diversity. There's no Gonzaga in the football mix, although right. Central Florida may very well be worthy of that designation this year. And they, by the way, I have to say that was the game
That's
of
great.
The weekend for pure entertainment theatrics. Nothing topped Central Florida, South Florida, which we learned since none of us were paying attention to, is a hell of a rivalry, you know. I don't know what rituals and traditions that they've established already, but I know they hate each other, and that which is good. So, but you're right, Mike. It is the usual suspect. You know, funny, the outlier. You said Miami, but Miami has a pedigree.
Yeah,
it's Wisconsin.
Yeah,
it you know
is.
Who?
Yeah, you're right.
But
yeah,
they're and yet you know they're in the Big Ten. I keep looking at Wisconsin. Can we agree on one? I think we could agree, the three of us, on one thing only. The rest of it we could debate. That of all these teams, the eight, the one unalterable fact is Wisconsin must win. They win, they're in. They lose, they're out. Period.
And they're
period.
The missed Chris.
Other teams
don't
can win
think...
and not get in, but they are in if they win, correct?
And aren't they, Chris, Chris, has there ever been an undefeated Big Ten team that is more of a mystery guest than the Wisconsin Badgers are this year?
Well, and they're in the West, the Big Ten West, where my alma mater also sits and has done quite well. So I'm familiar with them. But no, this is that West is kind of the wasteland of the Big Ten compared to the East, which everyone knows: Michigan, Michigan State, Ohio State, Penn State. But having said that, Wisconsin has had some great teams, and they've risen back up. I have no trouble with the familiar name idea, as you pointed out already. Of course, Miami is so great in the past, and that Miami-Notre Dame game just kind of, you know, blast from the past, came right back from 20 years ago and all of that. I think fans, frankly, love this. I think it's like, you know, it's the Yankees are out there. You love them. You hate them, but you know everything about them. So when you see these names, except maybe, again, for Wisconsin, and again, Miami being old but new, I think it's terrific. And to have Alabama sit out, there's your surprise. Alabama is not in these games, and I think that is enough of a surprise probably for one great weekend.
Everybody else pretty much controls their own destiny except Alabama. All they can do now is watch. Do we agree that even if Miami does what it's supposed to do this weekend, that it is the team most likely to get screwed by the committee?
I guess you'd say, although, you know, are you giving Clemson a pass because they're the defending champions?
No.
I
mean, if Clemson wins, we're not having any conversation about the ACC championship game. Clemson's going. They're the defending champ. Even though they've got a horrible loss, they're going. They're going. I think Oklahoma's going to beat TCU. I think they're going. I have no idea who's going to win the Ohio State-Wisconsin game, but that's the one that Miami winning and Ohio State winning creates the, don't you think that those two scenarios, especially if they both happen, create the biggest problems for the committee?
I guess, yeah, I would say. I'm just thinking about the, now I'm quickly looking at the SEC again and thinking, and no, you know what I'm thinking about? Auburn winning. I mean, how do you keep them out even with two losses if they beat Georgia again?
Do we agree that Georgia is automatically in if they beat Auburn?
Yes, we will. And by the way, you know, I think it's probably worth mentioning, because we're talking about Ohio State and the Big Ten game, you know, that Ohio State-Michigan game, which is really, you know, obviously a huge rivalry game always. The fact that Jim Harbaugh has, in his first three seasons, is 0-3 against Ohio State, 1-2 against Michigan State. He's 0-4 against Ohio State and MSU at home, and 1-7 against top 10 teams.
Without his quarterback, though, Chris.
Yes.
His quarterback.
Yes. But he's, yes, absolutely. And that's the difference. Probably the quarterback is not doing what O'Korn did. You know, he's, it's a whole different game. But in year three, Urban Meyer won a national title. Nick Saban won a national title. You know those Michigan fans are not happy with a fourth place finish in the Big Ten East. You know, that I think is important to mention, that Harbaugh has certainly been disappointing. And I agree. And you're going to give him more time. He's a Michigan man. He's a real Michigan man, as opposed to those other guys that weren't Michigan men but were called Michigan men by Bo Schembechler and others. So we'll see. But Ohio State has won, I think, I looked this up, guys. There are 18 Ohio State-Michigan games in the 21st century, in the 2000s. And Michigan has only won three of them. That's pretty interesting.
But Chris, I'll say this, and I'll make a prediction right now. I believe Harbaugh will be in the Final Four next year. I cut him way more slack than anybody from that part of the world does because of the youth of his team and because Spate got hurt this year. Okay, but if I were Michigan fans, if I were that blue and maize nation, and Bob, I think. I wouldn't piss off Jim Harbaugh because they don't want him. If he leaves, they can go try it with somebody else.
Well, they have tried it with somebody else, you know, and they failed. I think, Rich Rod and Hoke. I don't think they're going to get rid of Harbaugh. It's just fascinating the inability he's had to win big games compared to some of his peers. That's all.
All right. Listen, we could spend this entire podcast talking about college football. There were some interesting things that happened in pro football. And we can start with how much the Steelers struggled mightily last night against the Green Bay Packers. And Bob, what was McCarthy thinking going for a 57-yard field goal when his team had been the better team and whatever momentum was still with the Packers? They get great field position after the miss. I think it takes the Steelers six plays to score, and the game was never the same.
Yeah, it was a momentum buster. It was a complete shift. What can I say? I don't know. It was a guy's previous record high was 53. All right. But no, it didn't. It was woeful, too. It wasn't even – it was a pathetic try. So, it was bad. It changed things. And it gave – they were – doing a wonderful thing up to that point. They were really, really shocking the world, and it did change things, no question.
You know, it's kind of hard to tell if this was just another case of Pittsburgh playing down to an opponent, but the defense for Pittsburgh certainly is a cause, I think, for concern. And, you're giving up those long touchdown passes, and I think they've given a ton of those. That said, they come out with the win. That's the way it should have been. And, you've got Antonio Brown, who seems to me to be like the clear hero of this game after that miraculous catch.
So good. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, then he's, another amazing reception, and, he helps put Pittsburgh in position for that last second game winning field goal. So I think in the last 2 weeks, he's, what has he been on, like 18, 20 catches, and I think five touchdowns. That's extraordinary.
It was quite a day for marquee wide receivers, given what Julio Jones did yesterday as well. Those people and some of the stuff that I saw yesterday, I know I didn't see growing up, if you know what I mean. The athleticism was on display to a remarkable degree yesterday, I thought.
Hey, and Bob and Chris, isn't it interesting that these wide receivers are as gifted as anybody in their sport? And I've been trying to think of this. Is there more a dependent position in sports than wide receiver? Because you can be as gifted as hell, and you can be out there, and you can be running up and down the field, but you still need someone to throw you the ball.
Well, I always look at it, Mike. I agree with that. I always look at it the other way around. And when you see some quarterback statistics, and when you've seen the game, and you've seen the catch, the unmakeable catch that was made, particularly these guys, their ability to catch low, amazing. Because that's hand. That's phenomenal hand strength and supple, whatever you want to call it, as well as concentration and everything else. But I go the other way. I think they bail out quarterbacks a lot more than people, you know, than the statistics will ever show. Yes,
no, I'm just saying, Bobby, I'm just saying that they still have to have their number called by someone else. LeBron doesn't have to do that. Clayton Kershaw doesn't have to do that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, you're right. Football is really an amazingly interdependent sport. I mean, it truly is. And they like to say that all the time, and it's true. I mean, quarterbacks got to have protection. This collaboration between a quarterback and a receiver must be good. Defensively, there has to be coordination among different people out there. Absolutely. I wouldn't dispute what you say at all.
Well, it's also the highlight reel stuff. You know, it's, of course, those beautiful catches that we've seen. And how I think it's important to say how vulnerable they are as well. I mean, obviously, we grew up and your heart sinks and you remember Daryl Stingley. And I'm, you know, knock on wood a million times for the future. But every time a guy goes across the middle or reaches, and college too, and you see it throughout, you know, these beautiful plays that are just sitting there as the highlight reel, and we can't see them enough. And you've got to remember what these young men are going through. Great athletes, yes, but whoa, to put themselves out there like that, even with the way the rules have changed, and even with it's still scary stuff, which makes it all, it's kind of like the high wire act, the trapeze act of sports.
Look at what Odell Beckham Jr. started a couple of years ago. He makes the famous one-hand catch. We all oohed and aahed. I certainly did. I think I did a parting shot, Mike, on the show on it. And we see one-hand catches in college every week now. Everybody's doing the one-hand thing. I mean, no one did it before him, and now it's so another dimension to the whole thing. Because, you know, my pet peeve is I wish the NFL would adopt the college rule. To me, being a great receiver is one thing. You don't have to be an acrobat. 1 foot in should suffice. I really have a problem with needing 2 feet in.
Oh, Bobby, listen, somebody has to once again explain to me how these intensive replays have improved football. I know they get things right, but if anybody, maybe I was the only one watching it because they actually had a chance to win the game yesterday. When Tavares Jenkins, he caught that ball. That was a catch against the Panthers. And the Jets have been screwed twice by weird calls in the end zone involving the same player. But if that was really a bobbled ball, somebody has to show me how that was not a touchdown. Now, do we agree, by the way, that the biggest statement game yesterday, even though it was a home game, was by the Los Angeles Rams against the New Orleans Saints, the extremely hot New Orleans Saints?
No question. A big one for them. And once again, Goff stepping, showing himself. And I don't want to say, I won't even use that famous four-word phrase. I won't use it, Mike. I won't, but you know the four-word phrase that I would like to invoke. But because of my magnanimous nature and Christian charity, I won't use it.
Okay. Chris, what he's saying is, I told you so, because early in the season, and this is, you know, this is a conversation that's been going on with Mr. Ryan and myself since I was in college. Early in the season, Mr. Ryan got on the Rams bandwagon, and I was extremely, I think the polite thing to say was dismissive of this notion. Bob, would you say that I was dismissive?
Yeah, I was going to say you were skeptical to some degree.
Skeptical. Thank you, Bob. Thank you for that. And I was, as the Fonz used to say in Happy Days, I was wrong. And I'll tell you who I was wrong about last year, because Bob, you know, you heard me say this. There were times when I doubted whether or not Jared Goff was actually right-handed. Okay. When he first got on the field, and what a game he played with Drew Brees in the house yesterday.
Absolutely. You know, a week earlier, the Rams fell apart in the fourth quarter against the Vikings. You know, they just fell apart. And now Goff throws for, 350-some yards. And they did look like world beaters. And the defense clamps down on Drew Brees. Now, granted, the Saints in their 8-game winning streak got so lucky against Washington the previous week. Washington should have won that game. Nonetheless, the Rams haven't lost. I don't think they've lost back-to-back games all season. They're playing like a playoff team. Obviously, we'll see. What are they? 8-3, and Seahawks are just one game behind. You know, there's a lot yet to go, come here. But you've got this rookie coach, and you've got a second-year quarterback. By the way, second-year quarterbacks, Jared Goff, and, of course, Carson Wentz, just, you know, playing, you know, like latter-day Johnny Unitas's. But their counterpart, Dak Prescott, that, you know, that it's fascinating to watch what happens in the ebb and flow of these young quarterbacks, depending on the kind of tutelage they're getting and the coaching they're getting. But when they're in the Coliseum, which I love that they're playing in the Coliseum, the host of so many amazing sporting events, including two Olympic opening ceremonies and a World Series and all, you name it, Rams from the past and everything else. And then beating a team like the Saints, manhandling them, that's fantastic for them.
Wentz and Goff yesterday, our personal injuries law firm, the first and second picks of the draft before this one, Goff is 28 for 43, 354 yards, two touchdowns. Wentz, who really didn't, you know, it's like a walkover against the Bears, 23 for 36, 227 yards, and three touchdowns. So they nearly combined for 600 passing yards yesterday and five touchdown passes. And I'll go back to something we've talked about before. This is a good thing for the National Football League, because we were just talking about the established power structure in college football. We do not have that this year, especially in the NFC, even as we look like we're on a collision course with the Steelers and the Patriots and the AFC.
Isn't it great? It is just great. I mean, the Eagles 10-1, as you now the Vikings again, obviously, you know, then the Rams, Saints. These are all exciting teams. Going down to the Falcons, Bob, you mentioned them a little bit earlier. You know, this is, and still in the hunt, you've got Detroit, of course, Green Bay, you've got Seattle.
Panthers.
Yeah, this is great. This is, it's new for a league that has had nothing but bad headlines this year, and being, you know, obviously dragged through Donald Trump's Twitter feed, all of the stuff that's been going on, the raw, pure sports of it as we head into December, that is just terrific stuff. New teams, exciting names, young players, great games yet to come. A lot of them are going to play each other once or twice more. It's just terrific and great and so needed. If you're the PR person for the National Football League, you are loving this.
Bob, when you look at the Panthers, see, again, they're not new. They were, you know, they came very close to being an undefeated team not very, very long ago. And they had a quarterback who was the next thing, okay? We weren't talking about Wentz and Goff the way we were talking about Cam Newton at the time. He was going to be the LeBron of pro football and all that stuff. They are now 8-3, okay? And here is the rest of their schedule. At Saints, Vikings, Packers, which may be a Packers team where Aaron Rodgers comes back and is still might be noodling on the edge of the plus and the Buccaneers. Bobby, how dangerous do you think the Panthers are the rest of the way?
Oh, I respect the Panthers, and I respect the coach, and I respect our mutual alumnus, Luke Kuechly, and I respect the quarterback and so forth. Yeah, I'm looking at, you saw the game, I didn't, and I'm looking at the numbers, and I'm wondering how they were outgained by 100 yards and one, but one of the reasons you do is that Kuechly runs a fumble back 34 yards for a touchdown. I'm looking at, they don't really have guardy rushing statistics.
No, and Cam doesn't have good passing statistics either, Bobby.
Newton was 11 for 28 for 168. Ugh, yuck. McCown of 307. So they found a way to win this game. But yes, they believe in, you know, that's the thing. They believe in themselves. They believe in their coach, and they're not to be dismissed. I just want to throw one more quick aside in about athleticism and all. I just happened to see a highlight yesterday. We mentioned the Falcons earlier, and by the way, they're back in it at 7-4, and they will be heard from. And Matt Ryan threw a pass that he wasn't even wound up. I mean, he just kind of flicked it, and it just flicked it, and it went. It looked like, you know what it looked like? It looked like the shortstop coming in on the hop and the slow roller. You know, he flicked it, and it went 50 yards. I'm thinking, God, these guys are good. And not just because it's Matt Ryan of Boston College, but man, that got my attention. I said, who can imagine that? He didn't even extend his arm, and the ball went 50 yards.
First of all, don't dismiss that, because as Chris. You know, if Chris doesn't know, it's worth stating again. You can never go wrong with a Boston College man, Chris. Okay, you
just seldom. It's really hard.
We saw it
really
in the hard. Jets game. We saw it with Mr. Ryan. You know, every big golf tournament I was ever at with the great Dan Jenkins, okay, as I call him, the greatest sport writer of them all, he'd look at the leaderboard and he would say, that guy's lurking, that guy's lurking, that guy's lurking. Okay. For a team that should have won the Super Bowl, that suffered one of the greatest collapses in the history of professional sports, the Falcons are kind of lurking right now. They fought their way back to 7-4. Ryan threw for over 300 yards yesterday. That division is going to be extremely interesting the rest of the way.
Absolutely. And I know, I think, Mike, we touched upon this recently, that I would really like to hit the fast forward button immediately to the NFC playoffs. There's so many questions. I mean, yes, the Eagles look like the best team, but I want to see some of these matchups that could potentially come out of it with them playing the Vikings and some of these other teams. The Rams are intriguing, and now there's a lot of intriguing stuff potential for the NFC playoffs. Not so much the AFC, but definitely the NFC.
And can anyone answer this question? How the Vikings still aren't ready to fully commit to Case Keenum as their starting quarterback? I mean. Since he stepped in,
right? And I really don't know.
Since he stepped in for Stan Bradford, what was that, midway through a week, a month or so ago. You know, Minnesota's 7-0, and Keenum has a 97.0 quarterback rating.
He's in the MVP discussion, Chris.
I know.
He's in the discussion. He has to be on the periphery, at least of the discussion. So, yes, I know. Maybe they feel Teddy's needs a hope, or I don't know what I have to ask Mike Zimmer. I don't understand.
All right, listen, we will now circle back to college football, because this is a separate conversation, because something so bizarre, and maybe we can kick it around and decide whether we think it's unfair or not, happened with Greg Schiano and Tennessee over the weekend. He was designated as the new football coach at Tennessee, and protests because of his history in the Penn State program effectively got the people in charge at Tennessee to back off from their offer. And the complaint and the signs and everything were basically, Chris, basically they're saying that he knew what was going on in with Sandusky and did nothing about it. I don't think that's an overreach to say that.
No, testimony that was unsealed last year, Mike, detailed what former Penn State assistant Mike McQuarrie, his claim that he heard that Schiano, who was then an assistant a long time ago with the Nittany Lions, had witnessed Sandusky, quote unquote, doing something to a boy in the shower. Then Schiano was asked about that, testified, and publicly denied seeing or even having knowledge of any of Jerry Sandusky's awful, horrific, despicable crimes against children, child rape. That's the story. And what was absolutely fascinating, there's so many aspects I know we're gonna chew on here and deal with, but let me say this, the thing that hit me first and foremost was where we are in our culture, which I actually believe is a good place overall, the Me Too conversation, whatever. The words Penn State mean more now because of Weinstein and all the other things that have been happening. That is radioactive all of a sudden again. It was 2011, that story broke. Jerry Sandusky's in jail. Joe Paterno's was disgraced and is of course, passed away. All those other leaders at Penn State, you know, all the disgrace for them, should have deservedly so. But now, because of the heightened sensitivity in this country, in my humble opinion, I think that this then just became a wildfire, from an ember to a wildfire. And The Rock, as we saw the pictures, it was Twitter, it was social media. If there's no social media, this doesn't happen. And Schiano's the head coach of Tennessee. And if, of course, the Weinstein and Me Too stuff, which I believe is fantastic for the nation and about time women got listened to and were listened to. In this case, though, I think it brought the Penn State story right back into a place where it became absolutely untenable, even though it seems to me it's a very unfair comparison and unfair charge. That Schiano has dismissed it, and I would take him at his word for that. But we're in an all-new territory here, guys.
You know, we're all repulsed by the
concept of what of the transgression of the Sandusky incident. We're all repulsed by it, and properly so. And we all understand it. It is an extremely sensitive hot button issue, and I can understand the outrage of people if someone were thrust into their midst that was clearly culpable. But it appears very strongly that he is not clearly culpable. And there's a couple of things I cite, I'll cite. Dan Wetzel has been all over this story, and he's out there. Go find him on Yahoo. Go find Dan Wetzel, what he's written about this. And I just want to sum up. I'm going to quote today from USA Today, Dan Wolkin. I don't know him, Mr. Wolkin, Dan Deal. But here's how he summarizes what this is all about. And I quote now Dan Wolkin in today's USA Today, page 6C. And it is as follows, quote, "So, in other words, a nonspecific claim based on third-hand hearsay that was never followed up on or investigated by prosecutor in the case is literally Schiano's only connection to the Sandusky case, and it allegedly, underlined, allegedly happened when he was a low-level staffer just starting out in the business." That is the basis for the Tennessee fan outrage.
Chris and Bob, let me ask you this. And none of us has any skin in this game except when we talk about what happened to children at the hands of Jerry Sandusky and however complicit the school athletic department and administration with this. So Greg Schiano, he can be the defensive coordinator at Ohio State, one of the storied programs of all time, but he can't be the head coach at Tennessee. Where do we draw the line on this? And was this another example of somebody getting the media death penalty without basically getting to speak up in his own behalf?
Yes, I think so. By the way, Dan Wolkin, my colleague, is a terrific writer and great guy. And I'm glad you brought that up because I agree with that. But I think reality says we're in a whole different world, as I said. And this mob mentality, which this is what it was yesterday, I'm going to predict, guys, we're going to see this again. I think athletic directors are looking at this going, holy smokes, what in the world is going on? And I wouldn't be surprised if it keeps happening. I agree it seems completely unfair in this case. And I say seems because we'll never know for sure. But it really does. And I go with what you read from Dan there, Bob, because this does seem incredibly unfair to Schiano. But this is our reality. And wow. And I'm just, as an observer, I'm not saying pro or con. I'm just saying this is something. We've never seen anything quite like that. And let me just throw out one little other possible corollary. We know they didn't love getting Schiano anyway at Tennessee. I don't know what Tennessee thinks when Tennessee became Alabama all of a sudden and assumes it's just going to get, you know, the next Nick Saban. But they wanted Mullen. Mullen goes to Florida. And is it possible that they're covering here in some ways? Here comes the Penn State stuff. Very serious again. We're everyone listening. Very serious, horrible things. But is it possible they use that because they were just not happy with this guy, didn't want him, and so that's their you know, we're upset, we're going to kick and scream, and by the way, oh, look at this, we'll dredge the Penn State stuff up, and that's how we'll get rid of him. I don't know. But
Chris, for those people, you know, listening who don't know, there is a backstory that you are now alluding to, I think, and it's very real, and that is that this frenzy about the Tennessee coach story was exacerbated when they've been led to believe over the years that John Gruden would be a candidate. And this whole silly story that broke last month, John Gruden was alleged to have been dining at Calhoun's, which at right across the street from the stadium, and that's proof that he was in town to negotiate a contract as new coach of Tennessee. And it turned out he was in Seattle. But there was this frenzy about it. But the point is, they're taking themselves very, very seriously. That's a place people understand it that maybe not know how. Remember, they've got a 100,000 seat stadium on the river there. They've got one of the two or three largest basketball palaces in America. And the only reason they built the size they built it, and Chris, I think you'd back me up on this, is to make it larger than Rupp Arena. And they don't need a 24,000 seat basketball stadium. They take themselves very, very seriously there, and they're frustrated. They're off the radar. They won 19 years ago. I think it was 98. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm doing this off the top of my head.
T. Martin is the quarterback.
I was there, and I was in Arizona. I believe, and I was there. I'm happy to say. I was, and anyway, so there is a backstory. They're in a frenzy about who they are and what they want and what they deserve. They think they deserve, the resurrection of Bear Bryant. So, or General Nayland, so whatever. Anyway,
all right. This when the Shiano to Tennessee stuff was in play. This is what Urban Meyer said about Greg Shiano. He has been a close friend for 20 plus years. He's an elite person, elite father, elite husband, and that translates over the way he handles his players. Excellent coach, excellent person. So let me ask you this question. Do you think they didn't vet Shiano when Urban Meyer gave him a high-profile coordinator's job? And let me ask one further question. Does Greg Schiano now get to be so toxic that he's unemployable for a big job in college football? Again, he got flogged in the public square, and I want to know where he goes from there.
Mike, where do I go to get my reputation thing back? Absolutely. Let's assume he is innocent for the sake of and I really want to believe he is. And based on everything that I'm reading from people that I, the person that someone that Chris trusts and someone that I trust, and that's Dan Wetzel. So yes, this is a horrible thing for the man. He's too young. He's not hanging it up. He's got a future. It's so discouraging. And there's so many elements at play here. The Tennessee specific dynamics, the media, and of course social media, which is beyond totally and completely out of control.
Yeah, and I think to answer your questions, Mike, I believe Ohio State vetted him. I you'd be foolish not to, and I'm sure they looked at this, the Penn State allegations. Although was that last year that came to light? Anyway, it certainly would have been talked about at some point within the halls of the Ohio State Buckeyes football program. But I do really believe we are in a different era as of, 6 weeks ago or so. I really do. And I don't know Shiano. I have nothing against him. And I believe that I believe him when he says he had nothing to do, didn't know about what Jerry Sandusky was doing, et cetera. And it was, so horrible and so despicable and child rape, but just in the name of football, just disgusting at Penn State when that was going on. I believe him. But I don't know. I don't know right now. How could he? What? So let's say someone else. Why won't they do the same thing? We are in all new uncharted territory because of Me Too. And again, I am for that. I'm sure you guys are for that. It's about time. It's horrifying what we're hearing about Charlie Rose and others. But now it has trickled into sports in a way we probably never imagined. But it is here, and we are realists. It's here now.
All right. Let me just leave this here, okay? And I am glad that talented reporters are on this story, because maybe they will bring some semblance of due process to this particular issue. And I know, that all the Yahoos in Yahooville are saying, well, wait a minute, how come Judge Roy Moore didn't get due process? Read the reporting in the Washington Post. He got due process in the Washington Post in a 30-source story involving four women who had no contact with each other. So I am hoping that Greg Schiano may not get the Tennessee job. And I don't know the truth of what happened when he was at Penn State. I know that we're putting in a lot of stock, as we always have, in what McQuarrie said, okay? And I'm not dismissing the story he has told. But man, oh man, oh man. This wasn't even an episode of Law & Order. Usually that plays out across an hour episode. This happened in a weekend. Okay, listen, before we get to our parting shots, so you've tried all the meal kits out there. 30 minutes turns into 60, and all of a sudden you realize you're actually paying to do all the work. I've done it, and that ended for me the past couple of weeks after I tried Freshly. Let me just say this, because Ryan was at my bachelor apartment in my single days in New York. Freshly would have been a game changer for me. Now, some of you may be asking, well, what the heck is Freshly? Freshly is a weekly prepared meal service that delivers fresh, never frozen, all natural meals developed by their team of chefs and nutritionists. They're fully cooked, so all you have to do is heat them up. Each meal is ready to eat in only 3 minutes. So no more worrying about what's for dinner, no shopping, no chopping, no cleanup, but also no artificial ingredients, preservatives, or added sugars. Freshly is always fresh, never frozen, fully cooked, prepared meals that are ready to eat. Did I say 3 minutes? 3 minutes. 100% all natural, no artificial flavors or preservatives, no refined sugars. I've eaten these meals, no gluten, developed by chefs and nutritionists, and is a healthier option than everyday eating, and it tastes good too. The best part about Freshly is it doesn't take a lot of time to prepare and clean up. I'm just heating up meals like my favorite shepherd's pie, and I love a dinner that doesn't end with dishes. Try Freshly today and get $40 off your first two deliveries. Just go to Freshly.com/sportsreporters. That's six meals for only $39 for 2 weeks. It's Freshly's best offer ever. Only valid for a limited time. So head to Freshly.com/sportsreporters or enter code sportsreporters at checkout. Shipping is always free. Time for our parting shots. Bob Ryan leads off.
I'm easily disturbed, as you will see. Like, when is a touchdown pass not a touchdown pass?
Yeah.
If you did not see the Pats-Dolphins game yesterday, you would take at face value the assertion that Tom Brady threw four touchdown passes. Only technically. For one of the supposed, quote, touchdown passes, unquote, went like this. He's in shotgun. Brandon Cooks comes in motion from Brady's right. As he approaches Brady, Tommy Boy simply flips the ball straight up in front of him. Cooks catches it, and Cooks ambles into the end zone. It was a fancy schmancy pitch out, except it was a pitch up. Get it? How is that a touchdown pass? Oh, it was a great, clever, cutesy play, but it was not a pass. And how about all those times when a QB throws one like 2 yards out and a receiver takes it 50 yards doing all the work? More bogus TD passes. Beware of statistics is what I'm saying. Okay, I'm done. Bye-bye.
Baseball Hall of Famer Joe Morgan sent a letter to fellow Hall of Fame voters the other day warning them of the possibility of steroid users being voted into the Hall. Has this letter been lost in the mail for a decade? Morgan said other members of the Hall have been telling him they have to speak out now, with Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens inching closer to inclusion, to preserve the sanctity of the Hall, whatever that means, saying this issue has been bubbling below the surface for quite a while. Bubbling below the surface? Joe, what are you talking about? This issue has been churning so far above the surface that it has been screaming at us in 72-point headlines since Bonds sent dozens of juiced home runs into McCovey Cove in the early days of this century. How is it only now that you found the courage to speak out? Where were you when we really needed you, when you could have led a move to make all 89 players named in the 2007 Mitchell Report ineligible to receive votes for the Hall, a la Pete Rose? Word is that some Hall of Famers won't attend induction ceremonies if steroid users get in, diminishing the award ceremony, dividing the membership, and tainting the Hall of Fame. Think of all those years baseball's owners and the players' union failed to do anything about doping. This is probably what they deserve.
Carson Wentz will likely win the MVP award in the NFL this season because the kid is having a wonderful year, as is his team. And as usual, touchdown Tom Brady will be right behind, because if he doesn't win the award, he's always in the conversation. But to me, neither one of them is the real MVP. Aaron Rodgers is. Look at what the Packers were when Rodgers got hurt, and look at where they are, as hard as they competed on Sunday night against the Steelers. Listen, I know Brady is the GOAT. I know he's still playing at an extremely, ridiculously high level at the age of 40, which is like 50 in quarterback years. But the one time in Brady's career when he was the one losing a season to injury, he was replaced, as Ryan knows, by Matt Castle in New England. And you know what the Patriots' record was that year? 11-5. Now, Castle was clearly more ready to step in than Brett Hundley was this year for the Packers. But still, the real MVP is Rodgers, as much in absentia as when he was on the field. Thank you for joining us for today's Sports Reporters podcast. We will be back on Friday to set up the big football weekend, especially in college football. Just subscribe, download, go to wherever you get your podcast, because this thing is just starting to pick up steam the way the television show did. Leave comments in the comment section, because we want to know what you think. And have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you on Friday.